I was taken back to Temple. It's interesting. At no time was I asked, do you want to stay? Do you want to study? It was always a student. Everything was understood. There was no contracts. There were no promises. There were no vows. There was nothing. The next day, Maharaji instructed them to take out and buy me clothes. They gave me a room. Nobody ever asked me for a nickel out of this room. Nobody ever asked me to spread the word. They never did anything. There was no commitments whatsoever required. It was all done internally. And that day I met who was to become my teacher, Haridas Baba. And Haridas Baba is quite an incredible fellow, as I found out. I spent 5 months under his tutelage. He is 48 years old. He weighs 90 pounds. He is a jungle sadhu. He went into the jungle when he was 8 years old. He is silent. He has been mauna for 15 years. He writes with a chalkboard. He only sings holy songs. That's the only time he will speak. He reads and writes 6 or 8 different languages, like Chinese, English, French, Hindi. He taught me always in English, beautiful English. Maharaji has only his blanket, and they watch him. See, he's in a, I'll tell you about it in a minute, he's in a place called Sahaja Samadhi, and he's not in this world at that sense. And if you didn't watch him, he'd just disappear off into the jungle or leave his body or something, but they're always protecting him so that they can keep him around. So they've got an entourage around him, and people come and bring gifts to the holy man, because that's part of the way in which you gain holy merit in India. And money piles up, and so they build temples, or they build schools. They do all this around this guy. He doesn't. He'll walk the place, and there'll be a saint that has lived in that place in a cave, and there'll be a temple here. And then they build a temple. So, Haridas Baba, this little 90-pound fellow, he architecturally designs all the temples and schools, supervises all the buildings, runs all the buildings, has many followers of his own, sleeps 2 hours a night. His food intake for 50 years is 2 glasses of milk a day. That's it. His feces are like 2 small marbles. Okay, that's it. When the workmen carry the heavy rock, they call for Chota Maharaji, the little great king, like a comic strip. And he goes over and just with one point of his advice. And he took over my teaching, and I'll tell you about my life in the temple in a second, but he had met Maharaji in the woods, in the jungle, 15 years before, and he had become a disciple of Maharaji. Now, just to finish with Maharaji's type of style, I was going through my address book, and I came to Lama Govinda's name, Anagar Govinda, written Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism and the Way of the White Cloud. And I thought, gee, I ought to go visit him. I'm in the Himalayas and it would be a long trip, but I ought to go and pay my respects. The next day, there is a message from Maharaji saying, you are to go immediately to see Lama Govinda. This was going on all the time, by the way. A few more. At one point, I had to go to Delhi to work on my visa, and I took a bus. This was the first time. It was 4 months after I got there, they were letting me out alone. They were so protective of me, it was unbelievable. I don't know what they were afraid would happen to me, but they were always sending somebody with me, and, you know, like, they weren't giving me elopement privileges. They say in mental hospital. But they allowed me to go alone to Delhi, and I took a bus, and it was a 12-hour bus trip, which is a proud thing in India to go on these buses. And I went to Delhi, and I was so high, in such a high state, that I went through Connaught Place, which is the western hustle part of New Delhi. It's all BOAC and American Express and restaurants that serve ice cream sodas and, you know, the whole scene, which is right in the middle of India, but it's like nothing to do with India particularly. And all the Indians who hustle westerners walk around in this block. And I went through that barefoot, silent with my chalkboard. I was silent all the time in American Express, writing with my thing, you know. And it was so high that at not one moment was there even a qualm or a feeling of anything. And it got so high that I went into stores to buy things in Connaught Place, which is designed to hustle Westerners. And everybody knew I was a Westerner. And they gave me the stuff free. You sadhu, like blessing. It's a blessing to me that you'll take my son. That's how powerful the thing was that I was into at that moment. Now, after all day long of doing my dramas with the health department and so on, it came time for lunch, and I had been on this very fierce, austere type of diet. And I had lost 60 pounds, and I was feeling great, very light and very beautiful, but I decided that I'm still, there was enough orality still left in me. I thought, well, I'll really have a, you know, feast. I'm vegetarian, but I'll have a vegetarian feast. So I went to a fancy vegetarian restaurant, and I got a table over in the corner. I ordered a special deluxe vegetarian dinner. nuts to nuts. And I had the whole thing, and the last thing was they had vegetarian ice cream with two English biscuits stuck into it. And those biscuits, boy, I mean, imagine like cookies. Wow. And I, the sweet thing has always been a big part of my life. But I knew somehow maybe I shouldn't be eating those. I mean, that's so far out from my diet. You know, it's not vegetables, it's not rice. And I was almost like secretly eating the cookies in this dark corner. I mean, I was feeling very guilty about eating these cookies. Nobody was watching me, and it was all right. And I got away, and I went to the Buddhist monastery for the night, and then the next day took the bus back up the mountain. About 2 days later, we heard Maharaji was back. He had been up in the mountains in a little village. He traveled around a lot. He moved from place to place. And we all went rushing to see Maharaji. And I got a bag of oranges to bring to him, and I came out, I took one look at him, and I hadn't seen him in about a month and a half. I didn't see much of him at all. And the oranges went flying, and I started to cry, and I fell down, and they were patting me, and Maharaji was eating oranges as fast as he could. It was the same as taking on the karma of someone else through food, and women bringing him food all day long, and he just opens his mouth, and they feed him, and he's taking on karma that way, and he's doing it, and he was, he ate eight oranges right before my eyes. I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen anybody eat eight oranges. And the principal of the school was feeding me oranges, and I was crying, and the whole thing was very maudlin. And he pulled me by the hair, and it was left, and I look up, and he said to me, "How'd you like the biscuit?" Now, the impact of my relation to him was very profound in this sense. As they say in the Sikh religion, that once you realize God knows everything, you are free. And that I had been through many years of psychoanalysis, and still I had managed to keep places in my head. I wouldn't say they were good, labelable categories, but they were certain attitudes or feelings that were still very private. And suddenly I realized that he knew everything that was going on in my head all the time. I mean, I go back to temple, and here I was, an impure guy, and I realized I hit the jackpot. Man, I really hit gold here. And I'd be going to bed, and I'd lie down, I'd pull the covers over my head, and I'd have a very worldly thought. Not necessarily a sexual thought, there were those too, of course, but I would have thoughts about what I'll do with all my powers. And then suddenly, I would be horrified with the realization he knew that one too. And then I'd meet him, and he'd be so loving. Always so loving. And I said to Haridas Baba, I said, "Why is it that Maharaji never tells me any of the bad things like this?" And he says, "It does not help your sadhana." He wrote, "It does not help your sadhana. It doesn't help your spiritual work. He knows it all, but he just tells you things that help you. You know, he'll say things like, 'You gave much money to a lama in America 4 years ago?'" I said, "Yeah." And he'd always make me feel like I was a beautiful guy. So I'm going to feed one more incident into you about Maharaji, and I'll tell it to you, although I don't understand it, but I want to share it so that you are in the same position that I am about all this. By the way, the sculptor had said, he loved Maharaji so much we should keep the Land Rover up there, and it was like Maharaji got the Land Rover, that's all. One day, we were going on an outing up into the Himalayas for the day. This was very exciting because I never left my room in the temple. I'll tell you about the life in a moment. Now, in this temple, or around Maharaji, there were 8 or 9 people, of which Bhagwan Das and I were the only Westerners. In fact, at no time that I was there did I see any other Westerners. This is clearly not a Western theme. And in fact, I was specifically told in returning to the United States that I was not to mention Maharaj's name or say where he was or anything. And a few people that have slipped by this net and figured out from clues that I have done in my speaking and their knowledge of India where he was and went to see him got thrown out immediately. Very summarily dismissed, which is very strange. I mean, all I can say is, pass that information on to you. We were going to have an outing, and there were about 8 or 9 people, and whenever there was a team that would be involved, I walked last, you see, because I was the lowest man on the totem pole. They all loved me and honored me, and I was sort of like the beginner. I was a novice. I was like in a karate class or a keto class, you stand at the back and seem to learn more, and I was always in the back, and they were always teaching me. These sadhus were always teaching me. Everybody was very loving and very protective. So we went in the Land Rover, and Maharaji was up in the front. Bhagwan Das was driving. Bhagwan Das turned out in this season to be terribly high. I mean, very, very highly thought of and honored, and he would play. He had started playing the sitar. He was a fantastic musician. And he started playing the sitar, and the Hindu people were just like, just love him, because he would play bhajan, and he would do bhajan holy music. Better, you know, just so high that they would just go out on it. And I would live in the Sarangi, and Bhagwan Das was driving, and then there were all these other people, and I was way in the back, sort of on the toilet, which is in the back of the Land Rover camper. And we went up into the hills, and we came to a place where we stopped, and we were given apples and orchard, and we looked down at a beautiful view. We stayed about 10 minutes tomorrow, and he said, gotta go on. Got in the car, we went further up the hill, and we came to a forestry camp, and it turns out that his devotees are people like the head of the forestry department, so they make available to him all of this stuff. So we got to this place. He went inside, and we all sat out on the lawn. And after a little while, message came out, Maharaj, you want to see me? And I got up, and I went in, and he looked at me and said, you make many people laugh in America? Yeah, I'd like to do that. Good. He said, you like to feed children. You like to cook and feed them. Yeah. He asked a few more questions like that, which seemed like, what are those all about? I don't know. You know, they're nice questions. Sure, I love to feed children. And then he smiled and he reached forward and he tapped me right on the forehead, just 3 times. That's all. And then the guy came along and he lifted me and walked me out the door. And I was like completely confused. I didn't know what had happened to me, why he had done it, what it was about. When I walked out, the people out of the yard said that I looked as if I were in a very high state. But all I felt inside was confusion. I have never felt anything since then. I don't know what it was about. It was not an idle movement because the minute that was over, we all got back in the car and went home. I pass that on to you. You know now what I know about that. Just interesting thing. I don't know what it means yet. Now, I'd like to talk about 2 things. One is the specific kind of sadhana or method that I am involved in, including why I come back to the United States and what that involves. And the second thing is, what is the implication of what happened? Who is Maharaji and how does he do what he does and what's it about? Because it seems very obvious to me now and I want to share that with you. And 2, the implications for Western psychology would be very obvious. I was taught by this man with a chalkboard in the most terse way possible. I would get up early, take my snan, my bath in the river out of a pail with a lotha, with a bowl, go in and do my breathing exercises, my pranayama and my hatha yoga, meditate, study. And then around 11:30 in the morning, this man would arrive and with chalkboard he would write something down, like he would write, if a pickpocket meets a saint, he sees only his pocket, and he'd get up and leave. Or he'd say, if you wear shoe leather, the whole earth is covered with leather. These were his ways of teaching me about how motivation affects perception. in starting to teach me about what it meant to be ahimsa or nonviolent and the effect on the environment around you about vibrations. It started teaching me about energy and vibrations. The opening statement was, snakes know, K-N-O-W, heart. Yogis in jungle need not fear. Snakes know heart. If you're pure enough, cool it, don't worry. You're going to be very pure. Okay, so his teaching was of this nature. And it was not until a number of months later that I got hold of Vivekananda's book, Raja Yoga, and I realized that I had been being taught Raja Yoga very systematically. This 4,000-year-old system, or it had been enunciated, rather, somewhere between 500 B.C. and 500 A.D. by Patanjali in a set of sutras, and it's called Ashtanga Yoga, or Eight-Limbed Yoga. And also known as Raja or Kingly Yoga. And it was not taught to me systematically, it was taught to me all at once, but it can be broken down into what's called Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dhyana, Dhyana, Samadhi. And these 8 steps, the first 2 are concerned with purification, the 3rd is concerned with the state of your body, the 4th is concerned with breath. The 5th through the 8th are concerned with mind. Now, the basic understanding of what this process is that through a systematic, self-imposed discipline, one extricates oneself from inner attachment to one's sense data and learns how to direct and move energy within your own body. That's the simplest way of saying it. And it all dovetails so exquisitely. All I can say, it is one of the most highly articulated systems I've ever encountered, and the deeper I get into it, the more exquisitely profound I see it is in terms of an overall program of total cognitive reorganization and a complete change of energy expression or direction. Now let me be more specific. First in what the methods are, and then how the daily regimen of sadhana or spiritual path is. Yama, the first of the 8, has in it 5 components. Non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, non-giving and receiving of gifts, and brahmachari, or sexual continence. To say the simplest word about this, the non-stealing, non-killing, non-lying, non-giving and receiving of gifts can all be understood in the terms, well, first simplest way of saying it is, that it helps you to eradicate the entire subject-object relationship to the universe around you. That is, if you think of other people as him, her, or them, you are stuck in an isolated place. And the process of these is like non-giving and receiving of gifts means that if you are giving me a gift and you think I am giving it to him, forget it. I can't accept it. Because I can't accept a gift that makes our separateness more clearly stated. If, on the other hand, there is a resource and there we are, you need the resource, you use it. You need it, you use it. Then it's all right. In other words, it's the nature of the relationship that determines. And all of these things are to break down that place of subject-object barriers between people. The sexual continence one has 2 elements in it, as I can understand. The first is that most of the sexual desire is at the relation of subject and object, whether it's at the personality level or at the yin-yang polarization level. And it's a process of getting behind that one. We'll talk a little bit more about Tantra and stuff like that. And the other idea is that you are learning how to take what is called sexual energy or bindu and convert it to ojit. That is, you move the energy that usually would be localized in lower centers of your body and used for procreation, digestion, and survival, and you start to learn how to move this energy up your body into your head to use for purposes that will become apparent in a moment. So it's like conservation of energy at the level where you are still a finite being and have finite energy. The second set of things, the yama, is cleanliness inside and out, tapasya or austerity, contentment, study, and surrender. And these are very complex, and I won't go into them all. I'm just giving you the outline at the moment. Then comes asana, meaning asana means feet, and this is hatha yoga. But you only do hatha yoga to the extent that you are able to get into a firm seat, such as the lotus position or siddhasana or something like that, and you're able to stay in it for 6-7 hours. You're able to turn off your body. You're able to create a triangular seat and just put your body at rest and turn it off. And another reason you do hatha yoga is to open up certain nerves, because while we are very sensitized to muscular control, we are not sensitized to nerve control. And most of the nerves that I have been able to experience in the past year, I had never known I had or had never experienced in the sense of inner experience up until that point, specifically nerves in my spine. And the third reason for doing asanas is it's a form of prayer. It's putting your body into a certain position, which is a statement. The position itself is a statement. And to tell you how highly articulated this science of yoga is, when one has got it down right, your body is in a statement which can be thought of as a vibrational statement, which is in tune with a certain thing you visualize, which is in tune with a certain sound you emit, all of which go together to create a certain kind of psychic state. And these are all exquisitely articulated, labeled, and the amount of geographical description of the sound, sight, and feeling are extraordinary in these systems. Then comes pranayama, and pranayama is perhaps the most powerful of the methods, of the physical methods. It is a technique for control of prana, or life force. In order to do it, you work with your breath, or the muscle connected with your breath, which is your leverage on prana, or life force. And you learn how to compress, control, and use it to force energy up your spine, and this takes you into other states of consciousness. And now, when I am on my pure regimen, which includes certain kinds of fasting and living certain ways and so on, when I do pranayama, I am able to go into almost every state I could experience in LSD. And just as an aside, I would like to say that I am not taking LSD not because of any moral thing or not because of any feeling that it's bad or anything, but what I now see is that the psychedelics show one a possibility. They cut through the cynicism of the Western rational materialist and give you faith in another kind of possibility of your inner state, and then from then on you got to do something about it. I asked my teacher what he could say about LSD. He wrote back and he said, LSD is like a Christ that has come to America. He said, Americans are most materialistic people, and the avatar has come to them in the form of a material. How they will know about such things if they do not taste them? It is necessary for the young people in the Kali Yuga, in the Dark Age. And in a way, when you think about how Christ worked, he went around and he cured a blind guy here and a blind guy there, and, you know, somebody was dying or dead, he brought back to life, and he showed people that there was another dimension of reality. And he opened up a possibility, and he generated faith that spread out from that. And most of us that have experienced these other levels have supplanted the kind of cynicism with a kind of faith. And then comes the whole method of bringing the mind under control, or bringing it, or calming it down. Now, what is extraordinary here is that when I used to work as a psychologist in cognitive programs with people like Jerry Bruner, we were working in fields of cognitive enrichment and learning how to get children to think more and more creatively by reducing the punishment for high-risk thoughts, associations, and therefore increasing the rate and improbability of various associative patterns. And getting people to think faster and faster and faster about more and more far-out things. Now, there is a possibility if you go far enough out of that continuum, you come to the place I'm going to talk about. There is another way, however, of going to the same place. When Einstein said, I did not arrive at my understanding of fundamental law through rational thought, what we in the West have called it intuition. Now I understand how the game works much, much more clearly. There is a rate at which you can know things by linear thought process, by one thought after another thought after another thought. There is also a gestalt phenomenon of an experience of understanding how something is. This is something that is not in a sequential thought process. It is not thought itself. This is a method put forth by Ramana Maharshi, a beautiful saint in India who became realized at 17 years old, and for 50 years he stayed on a limoncello near Madras. Beautiful, beautiful being. And he taught this very simple method called Vichara Atma, meaning method of self-inquiry. Who am I? And just to roughly take you through it, I'll tell you how it works, and it takes a long time to do it, but it's simple to know how it works. He starts out and he says, you sit down and you say, who am I? And then you say, I am not this body. Now, you can put the I right in the middle of your head, and then you can experience your body as object, just your torso as object. And you can sit until you can see your body, like you're looking, like I was telling you about that first little side experience. You see your body as object, and the I is in the middle of your head. And I'll go through this quite rapidly, and then you can read about it on your own. And then he says, I am not the five organs of motion. And then he experiences his arms, and he feels the arms as objects with the eye in the middle of the head. I am not the legs, and he feels his legs as objects. The tongue is the third organ of motion. The anal sphincter is the fourth organ of motion. The genitals are the fifth organ of motion. In each case, you experience the organ of motion, and you experience it as objects in relation to the eye in the middle of your head. Then you say, I am not the five senses. Now, when you are in a room reading and there is a clock ticking, you know that you read and you don't hear the clock tick. And then you finish reading and the clock's ticking again. And the clock was ticking all the time. Your ear was hearing the clock tick, but you weren't attending to your ear hearing the clock tick. And this is an involuntary process for most people. Well, now, there are three things. There's the clock, there's the ear mechanism, the middle ear, the inner ear, and, you know, the vestibular membrane. And then there is the awareness attending to the ear. So what you do is you develop that eye, becomes that place inside, and you watch the clock tick and the ear hear the clock tick. You say, I am not the ear. You don't turn it off. You don't note the ear hearing. You note the eye seeing. You note the tongue tasting. You note the nose smelling. You note the skin feeling. Then when you've done this, I am not the five internal organs. And then you go through watching your heart beating, circulation, respiration, digestion, excretion, perspiration by inner processes that you can get hold of a little bit. Sometimes more fantasy, sometimes more real. Very slow process. It takes a while. Then you'll lose it, you'll suddenly be identified with your leg again, you go back and say, I am not the leg. You're going to go back and you go, it's a nature to go. Now you're down to one place, which is the eye in the middle of your head, which is the thought, I am here in the middle of my head. And then the last one is the clincher. This is the mind blown, literally. It is, I am not this thought. This thought. The thought of I am not that thought. I am in the middle of my head is the thought, and I am not that either. You see? So what happens then is your thoughts become like on the Times building, the news going by in a ticker tape, and you see your own thoughts going by, but from where? The minute you label from where, you're not that either. Because that's another thought, which you're not. Now, if you are disciplined enough to be able to do this, and this is a very steep path, and it is the hardest method. It is similar to most other kinds of very fair, steep paths, like Zen, for example. If you are able to do this, you extricate yourself. Remember that psilocybin experience I had, that place inside. You extricate that place from identifying with your senses and finally identifying with your own thinking mind, because what you do is you go behind your own thoughts, so you see your thoughts as objects. Now, when you do that, what you experience is very much like going through a doorway, and you enter into what is called a lower state of samadhi. You may be able to stay there only a millisecond, or later on longer and longer time. But when you go into that state, you go into what the Sanskrit literature calls sat-chit-ananda. Sat-chit-ananda, which I'll describe briefly to you. And this is explaining to you now where Maharaji's head is at, what's behind his samadhi, what state he's in. But let me preface it by saying this, that in order to get through that doorway, you have done that method. That method is a method of using the mind to turn in on the mind. You see how that's done? You brought the mind down, brought it away and away and away, and then turned it in on itself and said, I'm not that either. That's that method. You can get to the same place through breath. That is, I can take in my breath in certain ways and close certain muscles in my body that in the advanced techniques of pranayama, you take in breath after you've opened certain nerves in your spine. You take in breath, and through muscular control, you compress it, and you hold it for various periods of time, maybe 60 seconds, maybe a minute and a half, whatever. You keep developing different lengths of time. Now, if you are just busy holding your breath, like you would do when you're underwater, swimming, you know that feeling where you dove down very deep, and you're afraid you're not going to get back in time, you overdid your game a little bit, I'm going to die from not being able to breathe. Well, if at that point you are able to completely redirect your attention, if you've calmed down your mind enough, you can make it one-pointed. You can put your attention somewhere else, and the idea of somebody who is not having breath ceases to be. For example, in this exercise, what you do is you focus your consciousness completely on what's called the muladhara, the first chakra, which is down near the base of the spine. You visualize a yellow triangle of flame in which is a lingam, a phallus, around which is wound a snake 3.5 times with its head pointed down. And you put your entire attention right at that place. And if you can keep your attention at that place, there is no experience of running out of air. And after a certain period of time, through merely a subtlest mental process, you take this block of air, which you use like a hammer, and you knock down on the head of the snake. And the snake lifts its head, and it starts to climb up your spine. And you experience this extraordinary words will completely fall away at this point. This moving of energy up your spine, it's as if all of the sexual energy, all of the power, force, starts to come up your spine, and slowly it moves up and up and up, and you keep going into other states of consciousness, which are connected with these various centers or chakras through the body. And now, I'll tell you my first experience with it. I'm holding my breath and holding my breath and holding my breath, and I'm struggling and struggling. Can I hold it a little longer? And suddenly, I remember in the midst of this melodrama of, oh, can I hold it? I can do it another. I got 10 more seconds to go, and the seconds are going faster and faster. And suddenly, I remember that I'm supposed to be attending to the bottom of my spine. And I put my consciousness down the bottom of the spine, and a whole new process starts, and suddenly, there is nobody holding his breath anymore, and I'm still not breathing. And the awareness of that leads me to say, my God, I'm not breathing, which brings me down immediately. In other words, I pulled back. I went back into thought. In other words, I came back into my thinking, rational mind about you're supposed to breathe.
and having met a yogi who had been buried alive for a long period of time, whose arm was all eaten away by ants because they hadn't packed him well, and saying to him, well, how did you breathe? And he says, well, your cells store enough oxygen for your brain cells and your heart muscle, and that's all you need oxygen for. Yeah, the degree of control that's involved in that, or the degree of attention. I mean, suddenly you realize what kind of universe I'm catapulted into in these mountains, in this simple little world of these jungle guys, guys who are drinking like 2 glasses of milk a day and have more energy than anybody I've ever known, and who are tiny without big muscles and can lift huge stuff, and beings who don't have to breathe. I mean, we as psychologists can even imagine the social drive to learn, but like physiological drives, I mean, man, those are given. You can't screw around with those. That's what man is. Well, that's coming close to what the illusion is, or the attachment is. To understand Satchitananda and see where Maharaji is and how he's able to do what he does, I'll go on a really far-out excursion with you. Satchitananda means absolute existence, absolute knowledge, and absolute bliss. Try absolute bliss first. That's an easy one to get hold of. You do anything in life you do, say you're a high achiever, you achieve, and you solve the problem. You get the job. You get patted on the head by your father. You get the award, the national award for something or other. You get the raise, and you get a moment of, a moment of that feeling, a certain feeling. And that feeling is way, way inside. It's just a feeling of, yeah, right. And then a moment later, you're going to start achieving again, because it's very ephemeral. You are a surfer, see, and you go surfing, and you finally find that wave, and you're right on top of the wave, and you get into that perfect relationship with the forces of the wave, and it's a mindless state. You have to give up so much thinking in order to get into that harmony, and you're right at that place, and yeah, right, there you are at that place. You are involved in a sexual experience, and you get to a point close to climax, and you start to go into an automatic place where the experience takes over and the individuals involved start to disappear into the background, and there is merely a process, a very powerful natural process, and you again get that feeling of total what? Fulfillment, total here and nowness, total contentment, total, ah, yeah, that's the way it's supposed to be. Oh, that's gone. Now, that little place, which is related to when you cook a particularly tasty bouillabaisse, right, with particularly good wine and so on, you sit down and the first bite you take, you've been waiting all day and cooking this thing and getting the fresh this and the fresh that, take the first bite and, oh, yeah. I used to take Gourmet magazine. I've been the whole trip, you know. These are very familiar trips for me, I'm telling you. Very familiar trips. Instead of a motorcycle, you ride the motorcycle and you get into a certain centripetal relationship balance, you know, or hill climbing, a certain kind of leaping, or scuba diving, you're down in the water and there's that whole, here we are again. Always great, but it always passes. Always passes. That place, which we are inclined in because we are externalists, to identify with the method we use to get there. Like, man, sex is the trip. Maybe drugs is it. But scuba diving, all I want to do for the rest of my life is scuba diving. Everybody's got their thing. I'm a good mother. And my child is so healthy, I get that feeling. Thing is, that feeling is that feeling is that feeling is that feeling. And the thing is that the feeling is not the same as the means. And once you break that identification, you begin to see that what you're reaching for is that feeling, and the next thing you begin to understand is that feeling exists within you, not outside there. And when you say, I fell in love with this chick or with this guy, what you're saying is that person is a superordinate key stimulus that releases that thing inside you, innate releasing mechanism. You say, that is the stimulus that allows me to taste of love. I am in love. meaning I am in that place which is love in time, that place, that feeling. Now, to describe Satchitananda, let me merely quote from a realized being, Ram Tirth, who said, describing the inner place, which is, of course, indescribable, we can only sort of approximate it because it has nothing to do with words or rational thought. He says the following, I am without form, without limit, beyond time, beyond space. I am in everything. Everything is in me. I am the bliss of the universe. Everywhere I am Satchitananda. Tatvam asi. I am that. I am that. Now, what does it mean, I am without form, without limit, beyond time, beyond space? He is saying that besides the fact that you tune in on that place inside you, which is bliss, which is the place you were reaching for all the time out there, which turned out to be in there, that place of well-being, so that contentment becomes the standard operating state rather than the achievement. The other components are sat and chit, which is absolute existence and absolute knowledge. And now we're getting close to what Maharaji was doing, is that when you are able to go behind the identification or attachment of your awareness with your physical body and with your thinking mind, like a doorway, you go into a state where the entire world becomes subject. In other words, you went from many subjects, many objects, down to one subject, the I, and many objects, and then you go make that subject object, and you go into a place where it's all subject. Now, let's see if I can tell it to you better. I'll give you a metaphor, a gross metaphor, but you can work with it. Take a solid object. You can know, theoretically and scientifically, that this is slowed down light. This is merely a pattern of energy, and it's at such a rate that to our eyes and to our gross senses, it feels like a solid object. But you know yourself that with proper microscopy and so on, and infants, that this is in fact is a moving pattern of light. What is light? Light is in itself slowed down something else, something other kind of energy, or grosser forms of something else. Thought, feeling. All of it is merely various patternings of energy. If you can go into the finer and finer and finer forms of energy, think of this as a continuum now, get to the point of energy, the quanta of energy that is so tiny and so fast moving that it in and of itself has no individual differences. It is unique. It's separate from another quanta of energy, but it doesn't have any unique characteristics. That is, even the finest particle that we can call or label as separate, like an electron or a neutron or a neutrino or something like that, is in itself made up of patterns of this stuff. And this is all the same. All the same. Now, this stuff is moving at such a rate and is so tiny that it is totally interchangeable in everything of the universe at every moment. And I have experienced this state. It's called a clear white light. It's one of the ways of describing it. You get to a point where you see that you are in a solid. That air, bodies, this, light, is all merely different patterns, all like whirlpools of this energy, configurations or patterns of this very fine energy. And it's all changing so that that which is in you one moment may be in the life of the next, may be in Mars, may be in the table, and all of it stays looking this way to our gross senses because of these patterns. Just like in a whirlpool, the water keeps changing all the time, but the whirlpool stays as a stationary thing. Same phenomenon. That's the gross world. Now, if you can understand what going into Satchitananda means, it means extricating your awareness from localization in any particular time-space matrix. That is, if I can pull out from my body, from my senses, and even from my thoughts, then awareness I've got to give you an identity that is going to be so hard for you to grok in my line's terms. This is a really hard one to grab or to deal with. But I'll say it directly and let the chips fly where they will. That energy is an identity with consciousness. Not an equality, an identity. It is the same thing as consciousness. Not self-consciousness, mind you, but consciousness. Now, if you understand that or can think from that point of view, you can understand that when you go behind a time-space locus, you enter into a place where you are one with consciousness. You are merely consciousness. You are no longer me being conscious. You are consciousness. If you understand the implications of it, you have become merely part of that energy. Remember what Ram Tirth said? I am without form, without limit, beyond time, beyond space. I am in everything. Everything is in me. To take you to the next step, all I can say is that Maharaji is my mother's spleen. Thus, chit, meaning absolute knowledge, means that everything that is known or knowable already is inside. See how this works. That when you go in, behind, you come to a place where you are one with the universe. You are one with the universe. And at that point, you are it all. Now, let me explain what the Westerner's dilemma is. There is a fantastic Western attachment to the rational mind. That is, to know you know. Know you know. I, Ram Dass, I, Richard Alpert, want to know I know. The problem is that a finite knower cannot know infinite knowledge. It just can't be done within the system. You can get little bits of it, but you can't know it. You can, however, be it. You can be it, but you can't know it. And the problem is, here's what's happened. If you look at the evolution of man, you can see a drama that as man goes on this scale, this evolutionary sequence, which I can see as a sequence into higher and higher consciousness, man develops more and more capacities which bring him closer, but at the same time, they give him more powers. And over again, he gets attached to his powers. See, like you take the strongest ape, he's got fantastic physical powers, and he gets very attached to that. And the whole system gets attached to physical power. And at this point, this has a lot of power, too. Look, we can put a man on the moon. Look at the technology we've got. Look at how much we've done in the external world. What a fantastic city of power. And the thing was that the Vedas, the realized beings, warned us over and over again, when you get each power, you've got to give it up to go on. If at any point you stop to take your power, then that's where you're stuck. Stuck for this lifetime. Stuck for this realm. Stuck until you're willing to give up even that power. You've got to give up the knowing you know in order to know. You've got to give up that subject-object relationship to knowledge in order to be wisdom. And the thing is, by being wisdom, out of it comes the right response. But you cannot articulate the knowing you know at a very high level. I mean, most of what I'm saying is reasonably trivial compared to what it is that I experience. Ramakrishna has a beautiful example. He was demonstrating to his students. He was trying to describe what happened when the kundalini rose up the spine. And he said, when it gets here, and he described this. And then when it gets here, you feel this. And he said, and then when it gets to the ajna, you, and then he went into samadhi. He went out. And after a little while, they held him up, and he came back. And he said, now, as I was saying, when you hear this happens, and then when you get to here, and he went out. After three or four times, the tears were streaming down his face, and he says, I really, really want to tell you, but he says, the Divine Mother won't let me. She keeps stealing my lips. It's like you get to a point where it is not describable anymore because the rational mind and symbols are too inadequate to the task. And the thing is that an intellect, somebody who is attached to intellect, wants to know he knows, and you can get so close on that subtle plane of knowing you know. You get into what's called the causal plane, which is what the Egyptians were into, which are the basic laws of the universe. You begin to see how it all works. And you're getting to see how it all works more and more, and it's so exquisite, and you're less and less attached, and the less attached you are, the more you see. And you're so overwhelmed, but you still want to be the experiencer. Now, for example, when you go through that doorway, the first thing happens is you get waves of bliss. This is a very low form of samadhi, and at this point, you are experiencing the bliss. Like, you are having bliss. Can you imagine an eternal orgasm? I mean, can you imagine continuous bliss, just on and on and on? How long before you're going to get bored with that one? You enjoy it for a moment, and then the Vedas are very clear. The books of the realities, they say, get on with it. You've got to give up that one, too. You've got to give up each power along the way, because unless you give up all of it, you don't get it all. You don't be it all. The way my teacher wrote it on the slate, and this is the most profound statement he's written on the slate as far as I can grasp at this moment, was the sequence, desire is a trap. Desirelessness is moksha, or liberation. Desire is the creator. Desire is the destroyer. Desire is the universe. If you are feeling horny, you walk down the street and all you see is what's makeable. If you are hungry, you walk down the street and all you see is what's edible. In the same way, the fact that you are hearing me through your ears and seeing me through your eyes, this is a much more subtle level now, is the result of your attachment to these kinds of data. And it is only when you can extricate yourself from this attachment, it's very much like you are a television receiver that came because this is your trip through nature, as a nature being, you came with the channel fixed to channel 9. And you can't convert the channel, you can't turn it, because it's very attached to channel 9. Now, channel 9 has worked great wonders, because it's helped man survive and get to the point where we are. Where for many of us there is enough. We are not fighting for survival. We have most gratification of our senses. Now what? Now is the possibility that we are ready to ask the question. In other words, technology brought us to the point that allows us to ask the next question, that allows us to get free of the attachment to a particular frequency, allowing you to turn the channel to another channel. I have sat with my guru brother, and I'll tell you something, he's the sanest person I've ever met. And I can sit with him right here, and I can look at you, and he can be in this room, and he sees none of you, and he's talking to some other beings that are in this room. Now, you and I both know there are television frequencies in this room, and if we bring in a receiver, we can turn it on, and there it'll be. You can't see it. These frequencies are available. You're not a receiver for it. The reason you're not a receiver is because of the directionality of your receiving apparatus. And therefore, what the discipline of yoga, meaning union, is a process for extricating yourself thought by thought, step by step, breath by breath, from the attachment to your senses and finally to your own thought process. This doesn't mean you lose it. It's still all there. It means that it becomes the servant instead of the master. At the moment, your thoughts are runaway thoughts. They run you. So you're sitting here, you feel hot, the thought takes you another thought, that takes you another thought, you feel hunger pangs, you wonder what time it is, you look at your watch, your mind goes, it's like as Ramakrishna says, like a drunken monkey. A monkey that's been stung by a scorpion and fed on wine. I mean, a completely wild drunken monkey. You're having thousands of thoughts, thought after thought after thought after thought. So when you start to meditate, you first sit down, and you find a thing to focus on, like the Southern Buddhists. They'll put you in a room and they'll say, focus on your breath. When you take in a breath, it goes up, and when you let out a breath, it goes down. And every time it goes up, you think rising, and every time it goes down, you think falling. Say, do you understand? You say, yeah. And then they close the door, and they leave you there. And 2 weeks later, they come back and say, how are you doing? Well, what was I supposed to do? Just that. Well, didn't you understand the instructions? See that place? It goes up and down. Every time it goes up, you say, rising. Now, I, in the mornings, when I'm doing my sadhana, will sit maybe for 2-3 hours, just like this. Now, at first when I start to do that, the kind of thoughts that go through my head are things like, an idiotic thing. I got a PhD for this. Like, my knee's starting to hurt. What do I do when I finish this? I forgot to call Bailey. I've got to order that lumber. Like, what's happening outside? I hear a noise. What time is it? I'm nearly done. I've got thousands of these things. They're just like, they're like locusts. They're like little bugs, and they're just flittering around. Now, when you don't have any center focus, you have no leverage, so every one of them takes you on a trip. It comes along and says, here I am. Don't you want to think about your future? Here I am. Don't you want to think about physical comfort? Finally, you get to the point where in this exercise, all you're supposed to do for the next hour until the bell rings or whatever it is go rising, falling. And while you're doing that, all the thoughts are going by, and you see them going by like clouds in the sky. And as you let them go by and by and by, pretty soon, they start to give up, is all I can say, is they start to lose their ability to capture your attention. And they make a desperate struggle, and they really get good at it. Like, nothing's happening. This is absurd. Like, I want to try another method. And you got to be alone quite a bit to allow this to happen because there are too many external stimuli to hide in. You got to calm down. Now, when you get into this place where your thoughts have given up, you are then in a strange state, which for us is very, very scary because you're not thinking anything. And I remember the first time this happened, when I went for a period of time not thinking anything, and I suddenly got panicked, I thought, oh, I've taken too many drugs. Look, I've blown my mind. I'm not thinking anything. Because thoughts were money. Thoughts were power. Thoughts were the game. You know, I would drive across the country usually with a tape recorder and a pad of paper attached to my thigh. And as I go, I have ideas, research ideas, and I write them down. You know, I create designs and proposals and theories and think it all up and dictate letters. And, boy, I had a whole keep producing, keep thinking. And suddenly I'm empty. Nothing at all. And then I started to find out this very far-out thing, that the emptier my mind was, the more optimal my response was to every situation. Like, I don't have any plan for what I'm going to say to you. What I wrote down were the things it said in the catalog about what I was supposed to talk about. But I had no idea about what to say, but what I say, I say. What I say is a result of this situation. If you were a group of Catholic priests sitting here, out would come something entirely different. But what I had to develop was a trust in the fact that when I was not thinking, it was still possible to act. And the Buddha says, as long as you think there is a doer, you are still attached. You only get to the point where you begin to watch. See, from this place where you calm your mind down, the center you get into, this is what I call a witness, you develop a point from which you watch your entire drama go by, including your own thoughts. It's like you're standing on a bridge, watching your life go under the water. See, now, you've noticed that much of the time this morning I've been working with these beads. So this is called a mala. And this looks like, well, he's into a religious mushy trip, some kind of, you know, thing. This is a very exquisite heuristic device for cognitive measuring. It's not too profane to put it that way. And what, in effect, I am doing is I am keeping a mantra going inside, which part of the morning has been, part of it is in a Tibetan mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.